and without thinking lunged at Blackstone, who struck him down again using the sword's pommel. "No man who serves with me tortures another to death," snarled Blackstone. John Jacob and Kilbert reined in as Moulin joined them to stand over Chandos's man. The fight was over, the dead scattered on the ground, their horses running. Blackstone looked at Moulin and nodded towards the badly wounded Frenchman. Moulin bent and quickly cut his throat, ending his agony and his life. "Get to your feet," Kilbert ordered the humiliated man. "On your feet, scum, and beg Sir Thomas's forgiveness." The glowering men were as formidable as any enemy, and the man had the good sense to crawl to his knees and lower his head.
"I'll beg it freely, Sir Thomas," he said. "He is one of those put under my command," said Moulin. "William Cade, pardoned murderer, him and the 9 men-at-arms that came with him. They ride together."
Kilbert spat. Moulin gestured with his knife. Better to rid themselves of unreliable men. Blackstone shook his head. He looked past them to where the horsemen had finally begun to approach slowly down the hill.
"We need every man.
Back to Will and the others, before those men spur their horses on." He looked down at Cade.
"On your feet. You inflict torture on a man ever again, and I will kill you myself."
He turned his back and mounted. The hundreds of approaching horsemen, who were now less than a half mile away, had still not surged towards them. Perhaps, Blackstone reasoned, there was no need. They outnumbered Blackstone's few by so many that the killing could be a leisurely affair. All he could hope for was that his archers would bring down enough of them to give him and the others a chance to quit themselves well. He glanced down the line. Men crossed themselves. All had been shriven by the pot-bellied cleric at Saint-Aubin. All except Blackstone and Kilbert. If it was his fate to die this day, then it caused him little concern. It meant he would rejoin his wife and daughter, and that thought caused a warm glow in his chest that dispelled any fear. He looked to where Will Longdon and Jack Halfpenny stood with their archers. "Will! Jack!" he called. "Those tree stumps are your markers. The first is at 80 paces. The next, 133. And where that small ditch runs is the 200 mark. Give them time to get close. Kill them at 180, and those that fall will hamper the men behind them." The advancing horsemen came on at the walk, in a wedge formation, their leader astride a sturdy cob, ideal for travelling over rough terrain. These weren't cavalrymen on war horses. They were men who roamed far and wide and had strong, uncomplaining mounts. Their leader was too big for his horse. His feet dangled, his massive frame seemingly broader than the animal beneath him. His chest was as large as a barrel, and the long grey hair and beard obscured much of his face. The open bassinet showed two glaring eyes. Blackstone kept his gaze locked on the man. He seemed fearless as he drew up his men on the limit of an arrow's range. There were still English and Welsh bowmen who could arch their backs and whip their bodies forward to gain those extra yards, yet the man stayed unmoving. Was he, Blackstone wondered, tempting his archers to risk using their arrows to little effect? The two groups of fighting men waited in silence. The 300 bore no pennons or banners, nor were they clad in armour, but dressed in leather and mail with a cloak for warmth and a shield without blazon.
"Routiers," said Kilbert quietly.
"French are using them as well as trying to stop them."
"What are they waiting for?" asked Perrine.
"Wanting us to break and run," said John Jacob. "Or piss us off, so that we charge," said Moulin.
The routier's leader raised a hand and called across the divide.
"I will approach," he called. "Keep those bastard archers' fingers off their bow cords."
"He's heard of you," said Kilbert, turning to look down the line at Will Longdon.
"Aye, and you better not be my father, because then he's a dead man anyway," he answered.
A ripple of amusement rose from the men. Death might be moments away, but contempt of any kind cheered them.
"Come forward," Blackstone called.
The rider heeled the shaggy-coated horse. The closer he got, the more Blackstone sensed he knew the man. He carried a spear rather than a pike, a simple killing weapon, also favoured by Moulin, a pole 8 feet long with a sharpened 12-inch blade at its tip. Good for close-quarters fighting in the hands of an expert like Moulin.
I know this man, said Blackstone quietly. Kilbert glanced at him. I hope to Christ he's not your father as well, Thomas. Otherwise there's going to be a death in the family today. I'm looking for Thomas Blackstone, a boy archer awarded as a knight and a farting old bastard by the name of Gilbert Kilbert, who should be lying dead beneath a horse on the battlefield of Cressy 15 years back. By all that's holy, it's him, said Kilbert, and raised himself in the saddle. You ugly, broken-toothed whoreson! It's you who should be rotting in the mud at Cressy, he guffawed. It's Griffith ap Madoc, he said to Blackstone, whose memory opened the door to the time he was an archer with his first command, and had been protected by the giant Welshman, when aggressive spearmen questioned Blackstone's right to wear a Welsh archer's goddess at his neck. Griffith ap Madoc pulled up his horse at 50 paces.
Well, do you intend to fight and die, or invite me to eat?
You ride with the French, Kilbert shouted, knowing the routiers could be in the King of France's pay, and that there was still enough time to charge their lines. It would take only minutes for the hundreds to kill Blackstone's few men. Blackstone gathered the reins and urged the bastard horse forward before the Welshman had time to answer.
No, Gilbert. The French took fright when they saw them. They thought they were with us.
Kilbert spurred his horse to join Blackstone as the scar-faced knight reached the mercenary leader.
God's tears, Griffith. The last time I saw you, you and Gilbert went down beneath a horse, you with a spear in your hand and him trying to kill its rider.
Griffith ap Madoc beamed and cuffed Blackstone on the shoulder. Blackstone remembered him doing exactly the same thing all those years before, and like then, damn near failed to hide the grimace of pain.
And you were hark near to death, from what I saw, and your men still look as rough as a thistle-eating hog's ass.
Nothing has changed, said the Welshman. Kilbert drew up alongside him and extended his hand.
I thought you dead all these years. And I you. I should have guessed you were too belligerent to kill that day.
I was dragged from beneath that horse. But you?
The good Lord alone knows how I got away. I was hurt, but I crawled through the mud and woke up 2 days later among the dead on the battlefield with a scavenging peasant trying to steal my knife, so I rammed it down his throat. Good days, Kilbert. Days when we knew who we fought and why. Since then I have sold my sword, north-east up near the German border.
Blackstone studied the bear of a man. 15 years was a long time in a fighting man's life. What drove them to fight for their king was behind them, once they had been released from their service. The brusque man before him had championed Blackstone back then against antagonistic Welsh spearmen. But now? The hundreds of men behind him were battle-hardened. There was no doubt about that, and they looked ready to hurl themselves forward at the slightest gesture from their leader.
"How is it that you appear on our flank?" said Blackstone, "as if you had been following our trail." Why have you travelled so far from the German border?
The Welshman laughed, exposing his broken teeth through the thickness of his beard.
To kill you!
Chapter 11 King John II pulled his ermine-lined cloak around his neck as he walked across the vast raised courtyard of the royal manor at Vincennes. He and the immediate members of his council had moved the 4 miles southeast of Paris to what had once been his ancestors' hunting lodge in the Vincennes forest, but which over 200 years had become a fortified chateau and retreat for French royalty. It also offered John and his family safety from the claustrophobic streets of Paris, now suffering from the pestilence, where 100 people a day were dying. Legend and superstition said that the name of Saint-Roch should be invoked to cure the plague. But if this failed, it meant that the supplicant had grown too wicked, and that God intended their end. A few miles along the Seine, at Argenteuil, only 50 survived from the population of 1800. To John's mind, the curse of the English and the foulness of the pestilence went hand in hand. And Saint-Roch was deaf to those who prayed.
"Sire," said his son, the Dauphin, "we do not wish to impose more discomfort on your grieving heart than we know mourns for France. But Blackstone's continuing presence stabs at us like a dagger point wielded by the English king. It is Edward's doings that Blackstone secures the town ceded in the treaty. Does he intend to inflict this torment on us forever? Blackstone has destroyed Saint-Aubin-la-Fleur. That was not in the agreement, nor was the death of Bernard de Charité. His head was sent to Paris."
The king turned away from the gaggle of councillors. He had spent 4 years in captivity after being captured at Poitiers by the Prince of Wales and escaping death by mere yards at the hands of Thomas Blackstone. The king's courage in battle was readily acknowledged, but the whispers, even of those close to him, were that had he even half as much political wisdom as bravery on the battlefield, the nation would have survived. John had alienated Norman nobles, and they in turn had plotted against him and joined forces with his son-in-law, Charles of Navarre. Such conspiracies, John had decided, when being forced to surrender at Poitiers, had been as if the stars had aligned themselves against him. Not even a divine king could alter the fate cast by the heavens. And then, after captivity, he had returned to a scarred land, torn apart by routiers and civil war. The north of France was plagued by bands of English, German, Breton, and Navarrese mercenaries. Charles of Navarre still harboured ambitions to seize John's crown, and it seemed the English king was unconcerned, because such disruption kept the French monarchy at bay and less able to control events. And there was a private war, being waged by Count de Vaudemont, the royal lieutenant in Champagne, against the German princes, the Duke of Lorraine and the Count of Bar. A bitter struggle beyond France's eastern frontier fought by routier armies. At every turn, King John faced lament from his subjects. More than 120 castles were still being held by his old enemies in Normandy alone, castles that English and Gascons refused to leave in accordance with the treaty. Peasant farms and great estates alike were stripped bare by foraging mercenaries. Churches had been pillaged, stripped of everything so that services could not be undertaken. The wind gusting through windows bereft of glass blew out the candles. What manner of men stole glass from a church? Of what use could it be to them? Days had passed into weeks and then months while he tried to bring unity and well-being to his country, and in the end a part of him had begun to yearn for the years spent in England, despite the guilt that crept alongside such thoughts like a witch's demon. How could he not hanker after that time? He had been living in luxury, more a guest than a prisoner of the English king, not suffering like the French people. Along with other noblemen held after the battle, and whose ransoms were still being raised, he had enjoyed great comfort, even gifts. Living in the Savoy Palace, he had attended balls and tournaments, and enjoyed the gaiety of the victorious English court. When King Edward's mother, Queen Isabel, had attended her last tournament on St. George's Day at Windsor Castle, he had joined the English royal family and suppressed the humiliation of watching English knights beat those who came from across Europe. He felt acid gnaw at his stomach. Such extravagance was being paid for by his countrymen, who had been stripped of everything. And while John was lavishly entertained, enjoying days of falconry and unfettered travel between the noble houses of England, his nation had been left in the hands of his son, the Dauphin, who defied his own father and rejected the treaty. The Dauphin and the Estates General had poked a stick in the English lion's eye and brought Edward and his ravening army back to France. Were it not for the hand of God and the mighty storm that had slain so many of Edward's men, then the English king would never have signed a treaty of peace. And now? Desolation was everywhere. Memories of defeat and the sight of Thomas Blackstone fighting the Prince of Wales on that St. George's Day tournament have impressed between the pages of time like a child's collection of flowers and butterflies crushed between the leaves of a book. And even now he was not being allowed to forget the scar-faced Englishman. Even now.
"We do not wish to hear about Thomas Blackstone," said the king to his son. "He should not inflict any more distress upon our family or our nation, and we will not discuss him again."
John raised his face and closed his eyes, breathing in the cool country air. It smelled clean and sweet, and he had no desire to contaminate it with any talk of Thomas Blackstone. Birds were not yet nesting, but they sought their old places of safety in anticipation of the fullness of spring that would eventually rebirth the countryside. Nature's hand, easing away the ugliness of the ravished landscape, was something to be cherished. John the Good turned to his son again. "When we were released, we gave Edwards a kiss of peace, and vowed to honour the treaty. Blackstone is not the only Englishman carrying out his king's command."
King John glanced towards the older man who stood a few paces behind the Dauphin. Simon Bussy, long-time friend, senior advisor, and a man who had led the French Parliament, and who had endured the years in Paris trying to help the Prince Regent rule France in John's absence. Bussy's face was a mask of inscrutability. Ever the diplomat, the favoured counsellor would never show any sign that might indicate even a hint of disloyalty to the young prince. It had been Bussy's duty to support the Dauphin through those years of John's captivity, to stay close and advise in the king's name. John turned away. It would be unfair to press Bussy in front of his son. He would wait. They already spoke long into the night about how best to salvage France and make her the greatest country in Christendom once again. Long conversations without the Dauphin's presence, without the habitual coughing and sniffing. That a son's ailments could be so intrusive and irritating. Charles had always been a sickly child, and now, even as a grown man, his physical looks and demeanour suggested little more than an illness-ravaged, indecisive 23-year-old youth. He had lost his hair and fingernails, all, if rumours were to be believed, due to being poisoned by Charles of Navarre. John suppressed a sigh. If only he could have been blessed, like Edward, with warrior sons, and no in-laws trying to stab him in the back. The king watched a pair of linnets dart in and out of a bush as they began the task of ensuring that their old nest was still in place. They were an example of industrious endeavour, exactly what was needed for the French to rebuild their country. Their songbird trills were a delight. He would let them nest and rear their young, and then he would have nets set and snare them. They would make a delicious pie.
"We tire,"
he said, and walked away with a dozen lackeys close at his heels. As Simon Bussy followed the king, the Dauphin placed a hand on his arm.
"A moment,"
he said. Bussy held back.
"Does our father not see the threat that Blackstone might still be to us?"
said the Dauphin quietly. Bussy hesitated, nervous that his absence from the king's side would be noticed.
"Highness, our sovereign lord has the greatest task placed before any monarch. His country is in ruins, and he is near bankrupt with a ransom still to pay the English king. Thomas Blackstone plays no part in his future."
Bussy could see that the prince, who at times could be more petulant than his father, would need a better explanation.
He lowered his voice. "My prince, in the past your father and I tried to have Blackstone killed, but we failed. We set the savage priest on him, and Blackstone slew him in combat. Blackstone must surely be guarded by Satan's imps, and when you graciously kept me at your side while our king was held prisoner, you and I contrived to send him to the assassin in Milan, who had murdered his wife and child, and that too failed. Blackstone is a force of nature that I doubt any man can destroy."
Bussy did as he had always done when offering advice to either king or regent. He would pause as if considering the great weight that his interrogator had placed upon him, and that brief hesitation always convinced those listening that his answer had been given with the utmost care and consideration.
"Should we not abandon any further attempt to rid ourselves of him? Perhaps we should be grateful that when the Jacquerie scorched the land, it was Blackstone who helped rescue your family. It was he who gave you what short time was left with your children before they were so cruelly taken."
Bussy lowered his eyes briefly, a mark of respect and shared sadness.
Barely 2 years after Blackstone had rescued the Dauphin's family at Meaux, Charles's 3-year-old daughter, Jean, and her baby sister, Bonne, his only children, died within 2 weeks of each other. The Dauphin had taken the bereavement badly.
"Our children are gone from us, Simon.
Perhaps it was God's punishment for not putting Blackstone to the sword when we had him in Paris.
Our sin must have been to have let such a scourge on our land live."
"No, Highness, forgive me, but that is not true. You were in his debt, and you paid that debt by telling him where the assassin was. There would have been no honour in killing him when he came to Paris under truce. Boussy concealed his agitation at being held back from being with the king. Such a delay might raise questions, and the last thing he wanted was to have to explain to his sovereign lord that his son still harboured an unquenchable desire to kill the rogue Englishman. There were greater and more pressing concerns to attend to.
"You do not understand, Simon. You do not see the future. Our father will not live forever, and when we are king, we will face the threat that Blackstone and men like him bring. We may not be a warrior or master horseman like our father. We may not even have the strength to wield a sword. But we have sufficient intelligence to foresee that Edward will promote Blackstone here. The day will come when we will take back France. We will avenge Crecy and Poitiers. It may not be this year or the next, but do not doubt us. We will take the realm back from the English, and when that day comes, we do not wish to have Thomas Blackstone defy us as he has defied his own king. Our way ahead will be easier without him." The comment gave Boussy pause for thought. There was no denying the Dauphin had strength of personality, despite his physical frailty. Had it not been for his stubbornness in denying King Edward the full terms of the original treaty, more of France would have fallen into the hands of the English. Even when Edward had invaded with the greatest army he had ever assembled, the Dauphin had stayed behind the walls of Paris and let the English king fail to seize the great cities, denying him supplies by burning the crops and food stores before Edward could reach them. In many respects, the ailing Charles had outfought the great warrior king without even leaving the royal palace, and the boy had been astute enough to keep his father's counsellors close to hand, himself included. Perhaps Charles had the vision to see what might befall France if Thomas Blackstone were given more power and authority, and, most importantly, more troops.
"Then how could we succeed when we have failed so many times before?"
"You would not remember because you were engaged in attempting to save your estates from the Jacquerie."
It was a gentle rebuke, but pointed nonetheless.
"But when they swarmed across our land, the guards found a poacher in these very grounds. He had dared to clamber over the walls to kill our game. He was apprehended. We had him show us how he laid his traps, and then how he enticed the prey into them. It was skilful and took patience. He tempted those he wished to kill into moving from a place of safety into his snares. He understood his prey, and used that knowledge against it."
The Dauphin's smile reminded Boussy of a grimacing corpse, whose tinder-dry skin stretched across its skull.
"We have already set a course of action," said the Dauphin, "and we will share it with you when the time is right, Simon. Think to your own future, and decide who best to serve in order to save France."
In a dismissive gesture, the Dauphin turned his face away to gaze across the manicured gardens. Simon Boussy bowed, and, gathering his cloak around him, walked briskly towards the royal quarters. He served the king loyally, and always had done, and would continue to do so. But there was always a but in the corridors of power. Would John have the vision and strength that was required to strip the land of marauding fighters, like Thomas Blackstone? Chapter 12 Wolf's sword was suddenly at the Welshman's throat. Blackstone had moved so quickly that even Kilbert was taken by surprise. Griffith ap Madoc guffawed and slapped his thigh.
"I would kiss the Pope's arse if he created a miracle so that the world could see the look on Kilbert's face."
Griffith made no move to defend himself, but his eyes locked onto Blackstone. There was suddenly no humour in his voice.
"Thomas Blackstone, lean forward and press your sword point into my throat, and every man with you will die. Lower your sword and let me explain."
"It had better be a good explanation, my friend, because if it is not, your head will be in the mud before my death," Blackstone said and lowered the blade.
Griffith ap Madoc sighed.
"Christ! You were a mad archer back then, throwing yourself into the fight. And it would appear everything I have heard about you over the years is true. You're a fearless bastard, and I wager you place your life in Ariane Hod's hands. But I didn't know that you had attacked Saint-Aubin. Bernard de Charité sent word weeks ago for us to fight in the war in Brittany against Jean de Montfort's troops,
It was time for us to leave what was left of the Germans and make some money in the Limousin. Had we got here earlier, I would have been forced to make a decision whether to take the Charité's gold and fight you or turn my back. What do you think I would have done, Thomas?
Kilbert grunted and poked a finger in Griffith's chest. You and I faced French cavalry at Crécy, and we both saved the other's life. Men who endure that do not turn on each other like rabid dogs.
He has hundreds of men, Gilbert, and perhaps they didn't share your danger. They ride for profit, said Blackstone, looking at the Welshman.
Griffith nodded.
You're right. These men are drawn to me because I put food in their bellies and gold in their purses. But what Kilbert said is true. And I would have killed any of these men behind me would have challenged me. They know that. And what good would it do for me to kill Thomas Blackstone? I would be showered with wealth by the French king and his son, but I would be cursed by every Englishman, and God knows you English cause enough trouble without me adding to it. There's fighting and money to be made elsewhere.
You could have helped against these French, said Kilbert.
I did. I stood my ground and let them see our strength. They were only a couple of hundred Frenchmen going south to join their army.
Perhaps you were waiting to see whether they turned and ran or overwhelmed us, said Blackstone. Then you could have claimed that you had blocked any chance we might have had of escape.
You're beginning to sound like a damn politician, Thomas. Merciful Christ! I held back because the French knew we were not with them. They saw us and thought we supported you. Now, are we going to sit out here all day, or can we join forces and ride on? The French go south to fight Routiers.
And we are on the king's business, said Kilbert. There's no pillaging to be had. You and your men will stay poor if you ride with us. Griffith's eyebrows raised as he looked questioningly at Blackstone.
Some payment for our help? 300 men at your back is no bad thing.
You ride with us to join Sir John Chandos, and if he agrees, you can have the money from Saint-Aubin.
How much?
Said Griffith at Madoc.
1,500 gold francs, said Blackstone.
The Welshman grunted with pleasure.
You have it here?
Of course, said Blackstone. The sack is strapped to my pommel. He glanced down.
Ah, pity it must have slipped free during the fight, he said dryly.
Griffith blinked twice and then threw back his head and laughed. He gathered his reins and turned the horse.
You taunt your enemies and tease your friends, Thomas.
Did you think I would carry that much money? Said Blackstone.
What fool would?
The money is on a writ pledged by the king. Chandos will pay you.
The stocky horse wheeled under Griffith's hand.
So be it. Ha! You are a man worth following, Thomas. My men will bring up the rear behind your own, and we will obey your commands.
He guffawed again and spurred his horse back towards his men.
Griffith!
Blackstone called. The Welshman turned.
Your men at the rear, but you ride with Sir Gilbert and me.
Ap Madoc grinned, knowing full well that if Blackstone sensed betrayal, then he would be the first to die.
So be it!
He nodded in agreement, and urged the horse away.
God's blood, Thomas. These Celts are touched.
He's as possessed now as he was back then.
Better he's with us than not, said Kilbert.
He studied Blackstone for a moment. We fought hard, him and me, smothered in gore and with a rage to kill. We took the fight to the French and we bled for our king. There was honour in it. He watched the burly Welshman reach his men. But we cannot trust him now. Mark my words on that. He's dangerous.
Tell the captains to keep our men away from his.
You're right. Griffith ap Madoc will be a good ally, until he decides not to be. Once he gets the smell of plunder, he will turn on us no matter what he says.
Aye, especially if he finds out what we carry in our saddlebags.
And that you told him 1,000 less than we have. I was fearful the coins would jangle when that bastard horse of yours shifted its weight. They rode southeast for 6 days, skirting the towns that already owed Edward fealty. There were still a half-dozen more that were required to paint the English king's arms above their gates, but they could wait. By day and night the uneasy fellowship of Ap Madoc's mixed band of routiers rubbed like a wet boot on a man's heel.
Keep your stench downwind, Will Longdon taunted the riders, whose ranks were mostly Welsh men-at-arms bolstered by mongrel packs of English, German, and French routiers. After the Welsh, it was the English who made up most of their numbers. Some had deserted the English army years before to find a more profitable occupation. Others had been discharged like so many after the last great invasion. It made no difference which king they had served. The reality was they were only good for war, and thousands of such men roamed the countryside in various bands, led by captains, all men of fighting experience, all driven by lust, greed, and necessity.
"Sleep with your hand on your cock, and you'll wait to find your throat cut one morning," they jeered back at Longdon.
"Sleep with your knife, and you'll wake without your cock," others cried.
"If it can be found," shouted another.
Griffith Ap Madoc grinned and said something in a language that Will Longdon could not understand. The men who rode closest to the big Welshman roared with laughter. "100 paces and a couple of dozen sheaves of arrows, and I teach them to cry for their mothers in English," said Longdon to Jack Halfpenny, who rode at his side.
"If Sir Thomas trusts them to fight with us, then we had best not antagonize them, Master Longdon," said Peter Garland, from a horse length behind them.
"Do dogs' bollocks swing?" said Longdon. "We have to show scum like that contempt. It's expected. Us to them, them to us. How else are men to show they are men? Taunt and insult. It's necessary."
"For what?"
said the young archer.
"For friendship,"
said Will Longdon, shaking his head as Jack Halfpenny grinned at the lad's innocence.
"And trust," he added. "How else am I going to go among them and find out their true intent?"
Will Longdon had gone out with a half dozen men that day and brought down a deer. That night he took a haunch to some of Ap Madoc's men, guided by campfire and raucous voices. The routiers had looted wine and brandy from German lords' cellars and had clearly been imbibing freely. Blackstone's men, in contrast, had settled into their own defensive routine and smothered their cooking fires and extinguished candle stubs as darkness fell. The distance between the two camps was as broad as each group's discipline. They were a day's ride from where Sir John Chandos expected a routier army to be, and that was close enough for Blackstone to insist on caution. Let Ap Madoc's men behave as they wanted. Blackstone and those who had long fought at his side knew the value of letting darkness and silence cloak them. If any sneak attack were to come in the night, it would be against the routiers, illuminated by their scattered firelight across the open field. Will Longdon was welcomed to a campfire by men dulled with drink, and he played up his own part accordingly. The meat was packed into the embers, covered with stones, and more wood stacked on top. It would take hours to cook, but the soldiers would wait to a succulent breakfast. Will's generous gift was rewarded with a small cask of brandy. Ap Madoc's men bragged of how they had raided the French-German border for a year. They had fought and killed without restraint, and they had been well rewarded by the French Count de Vaudemont.
"We burned the ignorant peasants out, slaughtered everything that moved," one of the men grunted, eyes glazing as he looked into the flames. "Aye. Cats, dogs, women, and children. We swept through them like wildfire."
"And their militia," interrupted another.
"And them," agreed the man, "impaled them on sharpened poles."
One of the men stabbed his knife point into a piece of dried fish.
"And they squirmed," he laughed.
Others joined in. Will Longdon grimaced. It was enough to be thought of as a smile of approval of the men's cruel actions.
"The Germans ran like chickens from a coop with a fox after them," said another, taking a bottle from his lips. "We stripped their churches like their women."
More laughter, more slaps on the back. Men belched and farted.
"Griffith Ap Madoc took no prisoners unless they were worth ransom. We have moutons, livres, francs. Florins, money is money. Aye, and enough plate from noblemen and churches to furnish our own castle."
"If you have money," said the man next to him, leaning blurry-eyed into him, "we would take it.
You have money, Bowman, eh? Your captain stripped a merchant's wealth lately.
No. We suffer with a pauper's stipend from the king, Wolong had answered, adding, no looting, no rape. He spat in pretense. We live a poor life compared to you, lads.
You?
A man across the campfire said, pointing at him.
Even you are worth something.
Dead, that is. Better dead for us. You would have been lying face down in the mud
if we got to you before your captain burned out to Charite's town. We were set to make money from killing you, and those fighting against the Bretons. Count yourself lucky, Archer.
Will Londa could barely make out the man's face in the dim light, but he could see from the hunched shoulders and extended arm pointing accusingly at him that it wouldn't take much for the man's belligerence to tip into violence. He bit back the challenge that surged in his chest. One stride across the fire, and his archer's knife would be buried in the man's throat. He'd kick embers, and then cut and slash his way clear. Drunken men were slow off the mark, and he saw in his mind's eye the order of the killing. Instead, he grunted, as if burdened by drink.
First, you'll have to find us. We know how to hide, he grinned. 300 of you and a handful of us. What chance would we have, eh?
We know when to run. And I wager we can run faster than any of you. Chickens and foxes, eh? He squawked like a chicken. The men laughed. Longdon staggered to his feet and slapped the man's shoulder next to him.
I need to piss.
The man snatched at his arm, and he suddenly seemed less drunk than a moment earlier.
Archer, you're on the wrong side. You understand what I'm saying?
His grip was fierce, but it made little impression on Will Longdon, whose arms were cords of muscle and sinew. The men fell silent and turned their faces towards him.
You think you fool us, Archer, said the man who had threatened him.
Longdon's muscles tensed. His arm was still held, his knife hand.
You bring a haunch of meat. Why would you do that?
Will Longdon stared them down and bluffed.
You know why.
The men glanced at each other.
Bring your men over and join us,
one of them said.
How much? Said Longdon.
You want us, you have to pay. They grinned, and Longdon's arm was released.
That's what we thought. All right, we'll talk again.
Will Longdon gave a convincing stagger as he stepped away, and the men jeered good-naturedly. Despite the darkness, he quickly found his bearings, and remembered where he had entered the men's camp. A few hundred paces would bring him back to his own men. As he stepped past one of the last campfires, he saw a half-dozen shadows flip between the scattered firelight as they made their way towards Blackstone's encampment. But the man leading the others changed direction and stopped next to one of Ap Madoc's men, who was feeding his fire. The flames surged, showing Longdon the man's face clearly.
William Cade.
Chapter 13. Will Longdon reported his information to Blackstone and Kilbert before the day's ride began, and Griffith Ap Madoc joined them at the front of the column.
They bribe men to join them, said Kilbert.
What's unusual about that?
There are thousands of footloose men in France looking to make a living. Plunder and the promise of it is what we all seek. Every man needs to eat.
Longdon winced.
It's more than that, Sir Gilbert.
It's a feeling, is all. Something's not right. They aim to do us harm, I reckon. They are horse sons, every one of them. They slaughtered women and children, and impaled the men who fought against them. They are as bad as the Hungarians in Italy who burned their prisoners alive.
Yet they have not caused us harm, Kilbert said, and we have Ap Madoc's word that they won't.
He snorted and spat. But Thomas knows my thoughts on that. Blackstone tightened the saddle cinch on the bastard horse. It snapped its head back, trying to bite him with its yellow teeth, but he had already looped the opposite rein over his arm, to restrict its predictable response.
"You're certain you saw William Cade in their camp?"
"It was him," said Longdon.
"Aye, well, the likes of him would sell his ass to a mendicant monk if he thought it got him closer to the Pope and the gold in his coffers."
"We'll watch him," said Kilbert. "He might be deciding which side offers the most profit."
"They need archers. And even though there are few of us, we'd give them the advantage in a fight." They came to kill us, Thomas. But now they say they'll stand with us, said Will Longdon.
And they will, because they'll be paid. But then they'll go their own way, because we will have Chandos's men at our side, and they won't risk an equal fight. When Moulon returns, tell him to keep an eye on William Cade.
The bastard horse protested as Blackstone pulled himself into the saddle. But once Blackstone's weight settled, it calmed, ducked its head, yanking the reins as if to let him know its strength. And then it snorted, head raised and ears pricked. Moulon and Renfred appeared 1,000 paces away on the edge of a forest. They had reconnoitred ahead the previous day and slept in the barren wasteland overnight. Moulon stood in the stirrups and raised his spear. Then he waited with Renfred beside the trees. A chill wind gusted, crackling the pennons. Windswept trees lurched, bent from the constant exposure to the eastern gales that coursed over the bleak landscape. Their bare branches, not yet softened in leaf, clawed out for the riders. As the wind shifted and caught the fluted branches, an eerie moan rose up. Half-world creatures lived in such places. These forests harbored wolves and boar, and hid friend and foe alike. Better for a man to ride out in the open, better to die under a blade in battle than dragged from his horse by an unseen assailant, whether of this world or the next. Superstition. It could cripple men's minds or make them strong.
"Thomas," said Kilbert, "you think Moulon has found Sir John's forces? My bones ache with this constant riding."
"You'll soon have your fight, Gilbert. That'll warm you," he grinned, "once we're through that forest." Kilbert and Will Longdon crossed themselves when they looked to where the German captain and Moulon waited. The big man signalling with his spear again, this time lowering and pointing towards the gloomy forest. Kilbert grunted as Griffith ap Madoc rode towards them to join the head of the column.
"Madoc's more superstitious than any of us put together. He might not follow us through there."
"Then he won't get his money," said Blackstone, and spurred on the bastard horse.
He would be the first to enter the bleak and ancient woodland. Once he was far enough ahead of the cantering horses not to be seen, he quickly brought Arianhod to his lips and kissed the silver-wheeled goddess.
"Hold up," the Welshman called, as Blackstone nudged the bastard horse onto a woodcutter's track. He turned and looked at ap Madoc, who had brought his horde of men to a halt.
"We cut through the forest, we save a day," said Blackstone. "There's a track, and we'll come up behind Sir John's forces."
"You don't know that," said the long-haired Welshman. "You put 300 men down a narrow track, and they can be ambushed."
"By goblins and fairies?" taunted Kilbert. He glanced at the dense forest.
"They're the only ones who could hide out of sight. No army can lie in wait, Griffith. Do the spirits of the dead frighten you?"
"The dead?" ap Madoc snorted. "The dead?"
"Aye. Didn't you know this is called La Forêt des Morts?"
He suppressed a smile as the man who had once fought so fearlessly at his side nervously licked his lips.
"I'm not fearful, if that's what you think," he blustered. "But some of my men come from such dark and forbidding places. They've seen ancient forests swallow a man whole."
"Then they shouldn't have lived in Wales," said Kilbert. "Dark, miserable, pissed wet through, God-forsaken place. It's enough to make a man yearn for war to get away from it. Did you never wonder why so many Welshmen serve in Edward's army?"
"I know this forest," said Blackstone, cutting off a belligerent war of words before they could gain purchase. "My men and I used to raid here when I lived in Normandy."
It was true. He had. But like many others, he also knew that a place earned its name for good reason, and the Forest of the Dead was no exception. When plague had swept across France years before, the forest dwellers had died their agonizing deaths, and their bones were found everywhere by hunters and raiders. The woodsmen and their families had tried to run from the pestilence, but it had overtaken them before they reached the clearing that Blackstone remembered being further on.
"I've been through it before, Griffith. It keeps out the rootiers. Only those who know the truth of the place will venture in. No ambush, only the wailing of the dead."
But even as he said the words, a chill ran down his spine.
"We hold our nerve,"
he said, and heeled the bastard horse onto the forest track. The last time he had travelled through the dense forest, he'd seen bones of the dead scattered either side of the track. The way was overgrown now, but the semblance of a path was still visible, because wild animals had adopted it as a hunting trail. What had not been there the last time were the human bones dangling from branches above the track, leg bones, arms and hands, a rib cage, and skulls swinging in the wind that whistled through the forest, their grinning teeth seemingly moaning in a creaking howl. Bleached and beaten by the weather, rattling like hollow dice in a tavern game played with the devil, these were warning signs not to enter the forest of the dead, placed by those who had taken the woodland as their own. It was too late to turn back. Blackstone led the men at a steady pace through the trees, relying on his memory as to where the woodcutter's village had been, so that he might find their hovels, and then the track that led out of the forest. By midday the trees opened into a broad, overgrown clearing, and his mind's eye showed him where the huts had once stood. Since then the forest's tendrils had sneaked across the open space and suffocated what remained of the hamlet. The villagers' bones had long been taken by animals, but he still felt the presence of the dead as the wind blew through the gnarled and twisted trees. His imagination suddenly taunted him. Had he been lured into a place of death, so that he, too, would die there? He spat, and expelled the fear with it. They needed to ride southeast, and although the sun had disappeared behind the thickening clouds, he looked to where the moss grew on the tree's bark. Moss needed moisture to thrive, and would never face the sun. "Stay here," he told Kilbert, who was waiting at the head of the column, and eased the bastard horse forward. His eyes sought out the dark cloak of moss on the tree trunks. Then he turned his back and faced south, urging his horse across the opening, angling its direction towards the lower quadrant. It was as close as he could get to facing southeast. As he turned in the saddle to call the men, a movement caught his eye. It was fleeting, but the drab brown shape blurred against the far tree line. Alarm suddenly seized his chest. It was no animal that had moved, but the figure of a man who had darted back into the trees. And it was faceless. He kicked his heel, and the bastard horse needed no further prompting. It lunged into the overgrown clearing, its weight and strength tearing aside any clinging plant. As Blackstone surged forward, Kilbert led the men after him, and, seeing Blackstone with Wolf's sword in his fist, armed himself. Whatever Blackstone had seen had caused him to gallop forward, and this might be an ambush. Blackstone had a 40-yard lead when he suddenly veered out of sight into the trees. Kilbert swore under his breath. What in God's name were they riding into? There was no room for a column of 300 men to swarm across the clearing. Only the first 40 or so of Blackstone's men managed to forge their way forward, as Griffith ap Madoc's horsemen blocked each other's progress. The Welshman rode at Kilbert's side, no sign of fear, eyes focused on the dense forest. "Go left," Kilbert commanded, so that the men could strike in two columns. Ap Madoc made no complaint, and swung his horse as Blackstone's men split and followed both of them. Their horses struggled through the undergrowth, hooves rising and falling, chests forcing aside bracken. Despite the chill, their flanks were soon lathered white with sweat from their exertions. As they reached within 30 yards of the far side of the clearing, Blackstone reappeared and raised his sword arm to halt their surge. "Hold back the men," he called. Momentarily confused, Kilbert and Ap Madoc yanked their reins and slowed their horses. "Gilbert and Griffith with me." He turned his back and heard Kilbert order Perrine and Moulin to hold the men. Horses snorted and fought their bits, dismayed that their sudden race for the forest had been curtailed by their riders. The two veteran fighters rode to where the clearing merged into the forest once more, searching out Blackstone. They saw him on a cleared track, and then he disappeared from view again. Kilbert glanced at the Welshman. Both men were mystified, but they stayed alert, glancing around at the dense foliage. Ap Madoc grunted. "The old gods have kept me safe for many years, Gilbert, but I'll wager that your Thomas Blackstone might one day taunt them enough to abandon me. He rides into the unknown, in a place of death,
and then calmly calls us forward.
If Thomas is unharmed, and he's called us, then there's no danger, said Kildare. They followed Blackstone around a bend in the track and came into a settlement of 15 or more huts crudely built of wattle, mud and thatch. The cut branches and hurdles that penned their pigs and chickens between each hut helped their semi-concealment. A horseman passing by would not see them unless they rode into the hamlet. Rabbits hung from poles and a deer carcass, recently gutted, was stretched onto a gutting frame. There was no smoke coming from the roof smoke holes, but now that they were close and the wind was in their faces, they sensed the dank smell of wet fire. These wood-dwellers had doused their fires when the intruders rode into their forest. Blackstone sat astride the bastard horse and looked at the dozen faceless men dressed in ragged clothing. Their heads were covered in coifs, but their faces were bandaged with a gauze-like material that obscured their features. What was left of their hands, also bandaged, gripped staves and axes.
"Mother of Christ," Kildare whispered.
"Lepers." Chapter 14 Blackstone faced Kildare and Ap Madoc. "They tell me they've been living here for 3 years. There are 50 or more of them, men and women, a few children. They scavenge, trap, and hunt." The two men stayed back.
"Come closer," said Blackstone.
"You'll not be infected." He looked at the bandaged men, who stood defiantly in a half-circle in front of their huts. "They need no leper's clapper out here. They're free men, as free as they can be." Blackstone dismounted to show Kildare and Ap Madoc not to be afraid. "When Christiana and I escaped from the savage priest in Paris, we hid in the leper colony north of the city walls. They offered us food and kindness. We accepted both." The man who seemed to be their leader said something, his voice muffled behind the cloth across his face. Blackstone was near enough to hear him.
"Then we will give you what we have in return," Blackstone answered.
He looked back to where Kildare and Griffith still sat uneasily. A third figure had ridden forward from the clearing. William Cade looked at the diseased men and women.
"Burn them up," he said. "Kill them and put their bodies in the fires. They infect the air we breathe. Best be rid of them."
Kildare turned on him. "Keep your horse and mouth shut. You have no business here, and you do not tell Sir Thomas Blackstone what to do. Get yourself back to the others." Cade was unperturbed by Kildare's anger. He shrugged and then spat.
"If you don't have a stomach for it, Sir Gilbert, the Welshman will do it. He and his men have slain women and children in their droves."
"Be quiet," said Ap Madoc.
"What I have done is my business. Do you think Sir John will want any of us to ride with him, once he learns we breathe the same air as lepers?" sneered Cade, drawing his sword. "Stand aside, I'll do it myself."
Griffith Ap Madoc suddenly swung an arm as thick as a man's thigh and caught Cade across the chest. The blow tumbled him from his horse, but he rolled and quickly got to his feet. His fighting skills were in his blood, as the leper's affliction was in theirs. Blackstone took three of his long strides and gripped Cade's sword arm as he prepared to lunge at the Welshman. Cade's muscles were taut from years of fighting, but Blackstone's grip stopped his strike as surely as if his arm had been severed.
"That's the second time I've had cause to stop you. The next time, I'll kill you," said Blackstone quietly.
He released his grip and shouldered the tough killer aside. "Ride back to the men and send Renfred to me, with the sacks of flour on the pack horses." Once again, William Cade bowed his head from the admonishment.
"I beg forgiveness, Sir Thomas. I thought only of you and the men. The air here is foul, and we always slay lepers."
"It seems to me you would slay any living thing given the chance," said Blackstone. "Get yourself back." Cade sheathed his sword and climbed into the saddle. By the time his back was turned, Blackstone looked at the two men who still waited at a safe distance.
"When we get to Sir John, I want rid of him," said Blackstone.
"You should have let Moulin cut his throat when we had just cause," said Kildare. Griffith Ap Madoc knew nothing of the incident when Cade had tortured the Frenchman.
He came to me last night to sell his sword, he said. Kildare glanced at Blackstone. The Welshman's confession was in his favour. We know he skulked in the night to see you, said Kildare. Not hard to imagine why. We'll deal with him later, said Blackstone. Right now, I've got us lost in this damned forest. And the flowers for them by way of barter? To get us out of here, said Kildare. Aye. We'll get more when we reach Sir John. They'll lead us out. I'll get back to the men, said Kildare. And I to mine, said Ap Madoc. They turned their horses.
Your friends are frightened of us, said the leper.
Yes.
They should be. Who knows how we become afflicted? But you are not afraid?
You heard what I said about my escape from Paris. The leper turned and instructed the others.
Stay alert. Some of those men wish us harm.
You'll not be harmed, if I say you won't, said Blackstone.
I accept your word, said the leper, but we are vulnerable now. No one has ever ventured into this forest since we settled here. The bones of the dead and the legend kept all but you away. And now your men know about us. Others might return.
I give you my apologies. What will you do?
Move deeper. We do not blame you, Thomas Blackstone.
Blackstone's chin lifted in surprise at the man addressing him by his name.
Your man called you Sir Thomas. There are many men known as such, but I know who you are.
Come, said the leper, and led the way towards one of the huts. They stood aside and appeared to offer no threat. Blackstone knew it would have been an act of folly for them to cause him harm, but his senses were alert as he stepped into the windowless hut. A dull glow from a tallow lamp lit the room softly as the leper went to an iron-edged wood chest and lifted the lid. His disfigured, bandaged hand held up a surcoat. The armorial design of a chevron against green background was barely visible beneath the ingrained dark stains on the worn cloth. Blood had soaked and dried, permanently discoloring the linen.
I wore my lord's blazon, said the leper. Henri de Caussin. We fought you at Poitiers. I was 20 paces from you when you tried to kill our king. I recognized your shield the moment you entered the forest.
Blackstone's sense of being watched had been borne out.
I was stricken with leprosy a year later, said the man, spared in battle and condemned to a living death.
Which takes a greater courage, said Blackstone. The man grunted.
Perhaps, he said,
but I was outcast. He replaced the treasured cloth from a time when he was as sturdy and strong as the man who stood before him, and stepped closer to Blackstone so that he could see his eyes were infected. Skin bubbled the flesh around them, and the thin gauze showed similar disfigurement below the covering.
And then, like you, I was banished. You by your prince, me by my fate. Banished from my wife, my lord, my town, and my children. And now, here you are, giving us your protection.
Renfred's voice called from outside. Sir Thomas!
And your flower, said the leper.
Blackstone sensed that the man smiled. The leper stepped out of the hut. Blackstone followed. Renfred had dropped 2 sacks of flour onto the ground and kept his distance from the gathered men. "Ride back! I'll follow," said Blackstone. The German captain hesitated, looking nervously at the gathered men. "Go! There's no danger. Have Sir Gilbert form the men into column again. We're leaving." Renfred tugged the reins and spurred his horse.
"I will lead you out," said the leper. "There are animal tracks we use when we go to the towns to beg. There's a convent that gives us arms and food that help us trade among ourselves. When I leave you at the forest's edge, turn south for 8 leagues, then east for another 6. You will find the men you seek there."
"You've seen them?"
"Chandos,"
Yes, we saw his banner. We know our enemies from the past, Sir Thomas, but perhaps it is they who will rid us of the